Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, for the most part, bad and crazy martinis for conservatives today, all brought to you by Wink. Discover great wine today. Go to trywink.com/martini to get $20 off your first shipment. That's spelled trywink.com/martini. trywink.com/martini. More on that a little bit later in the podcast. And Jim, our good martini is that the Republicans won a special House race. Yes, in Arizona's 8th Congressional District. This is a district that Trent Franks won easily. I think sometimes he was even unopposed. He, of course, resigned, I believe, last year. This is not supposed to be huge news. This should have been a laugher, but after Democrats found a way to win in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district that Trump also won by 20 points, hey, we'll take good news anywhere we can find it. Here's Politico. Republican Debbie Lesko won the House special election in Arizona Tuesday night, holding off a closer-than-expected Democratic challenge in a district that President Donald Trump won by 21 points in 2016. Lesko had 53% of the vote when the Associated Press called the race an hour after the polls closed, with over 155,000 early votes tallied. Democrat Hiral Tipperneni had 47% of the vote, but Lesko's single-digit margin is the latest evidence that Republicans face a punishing midterm environment, even in Trump-friendly territory. They talk about Pennsylvania. They talk about the Alabama Senate race. And then they quote this guy, Mike Noble, a Republican pollster based in Arizona. Republicans shouldn't be hitting the alarm. They should be slamming it. This district isn't supposed to be competitive. So, Jim, obviously we'd have loved to see a much more healthy margin of victory here. So there is still reason to be concerned about the midterms, obviously. But, hey, we got to win and we'll take it.
As we're having this conversation, Greg, I'm seeing from Keith Appel, a conservative communications consultant, describes it as this is getting a couple of first downs after you've been pinned inside by the 5-yard line on a good punt by the other team. It is worth noting, yeah, this is where Trent Franks usually won by 60-some percent. It's easy to say, look, the Democrats didn't even run anybody in 2014 and 2016. And I checked, the Green candidate got 30-some percent against Franks in 2016. So it's not like there aren't Democrats in this district. So we shouldn't say, like, oh, my goodness, you know, this is a winning by five is not ideal. You'd like to see it winning by comparable margins. But, you know, this is a special election. It's late April. You know, I've heard some people saying that Lesko was not exactly a whirling dervish of raw political charisma, et cetera, et cetera. Look, this is good enough news. Perhaps this makes it our good enough martini, Greg. We saw in 18th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, Connor Lamb winning, all right, by a small margin, but one that, you know, had been a reliably Republican district. So you have a situation in which, you know, we have one very narrow defeat and one not great, but, you know, okay victory. If that happens in a lot of – if you have more of these in Republican districts, they're not going to be in as much bad shape. People may remember a couple months ago I looked at all the open seats and said, look, most of these are pretty heavily Republican districts. I think I had this one on the list as well. Take nothing for granted. I was talking to a Republican strategist yesterday who was saying, look, some of this reflects the fact that special elections, a good portion of our base is not paying attention right now and is kind of tuned out. They know there are elections in November of even numbered years. And I can only say, Greg, I hope they know that.
That would be good. All right. Well, let's talk about other perhaps future political campaigns. At one point, this person said 2020. Now he's tweeting 2024. Jim, this one really gets under my skin for a couple of reasons. First of all of us on the right, our instinct every time a celebrity bashes a conservative person, a conservative ideal, it's always the same. Shut up, Rob Reiner. Shut up, Sean Penn, Alyssa Milano, you're not helping anything. Go away. As Laura Ingraham says, shut up and sing, or to LeBron James, shut up and dribble, that got her in trouble. But anytime a celebrity says something that sounds mildly conservative or at least mildly critical of the left, oh, we love you. And then we exalt them. And now it's Kanye West, for heaven's sake, that people are just flocking to. over the weekend. He said, I love the way Candace Owens thinks. Candace Owens is a black female conservative. She works for Turning Point USA, works a lot with liberalism and groupthink on college campuses and fighting against that. And so a lot of people love that tweet. And then later that either that day or at least on the weekend, he said, we have freedom of speech, but not freedom of thought. Then he says the thought police want to suppress freedom of thought, and a few more tweets along those lines. And all of a sudden now Kanye West is the hero of at least some on the right. And people are quickly forgetting that he said this on the live Katrina fundraiser broadcast in 2005.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Now, he did apologize for that. Bush accepted the apology, so I guess we should all move on. But, Jim, this guy's a loose cannon. Apparently, some on the right love loose cannons, looking at who's in the White House right now. But the idea that Kanye West is the person we want bearing the flag for the conservative movement is insane.
What's the matter, Greg? You don't like the idea of future First Lady Kim Kardashian?
I'm not actually even going to be surprised if that happens anymore after this. But this guy's completely unhinged.
It was really intriguing to see, let's face it, on a normal day, Kanye West is kind of indecipherable to begin with.
Right.
I mean, it's some combination of egomania, philosophy. Occasionally you pick up a little bit of an encouraging self-help vibe from him. But half the time it's just not all that coherent. So all of a sudden he says something that kind of sort, you know, I guess you could say it's an endorsing this particular figure on the right. I'm not really seeing grand comprehensive treaties on political philosophy coming from Kanye West. And if this is what we mean by Western civilization, Greg, your assessment of the dynamic on the right of we hate celebrities until they say something that's kind of sort of, if you look at it in a certain light, it almost kind of sounds conservative. We love them. Now, I'll emphasize that I liked Adam Baldwin before I knew he was conservative. I just liked the way he was Jane on Firefly and things like that. But this idea that Kanye is a pretty good example of this, just because of all the sheer number of times he said and done things that were obnoxious or insufferably narcissistic. I should have interrupted your opening statement there, Greg. I'm going to let you finish. But Kanye West is the biggest jackass of all time. And when I say jackass, oh, Jim, how can you use that language on this podcast? Well, I'm only quoting President Obama shortly thereafter, after his stunt at the MTV Music Awards. So, again, this look, if Kanye West genuinely is rethinking whatever left of center political waters he's been swimming in, it's his statements that, you know, we have this, you know, that there is a soft political thought police or you know, things like that going on, fine. If he wants to talk about the value of being true to yourself and finding your own path and your own truth and not letting people shout you down, okay, good for you, you know, good for you, Kanye. But I kind of wish we didn't have this predictable lemming-like rush. And also, by the way, it's also kind of fascinating, Greg, to watch some folks on the left, oh, now they're offended by Kanye. Right. This was the breaking point. This was the moment where all of a sudden, wait a minute. I'm starting to think this Kanye fellow isn't the upstanding, you know, bright young man that I always thought he was. No. Starting to think there's a little bit of showmanship and narcissism going on here.
It could be. I think we're seeing that with the Roseanne effect, too. Roseanne's kind of crazy, but she likes Trump and her character on the show likes Trump. And so people are now warming up to her on the right. I think where we got derailed, Jim, is we started well. We had a great celebrity that we loved in Reagan, right? He eventually became governor and president, turned out to be a great conservative. So then we somehow came to the conclusion, or at least a lot on the right did, that, hey, more Republican celebrities would be great. So instead of electing somebody like Tom McClintock, governor of California, they elect Arnold Schwarzenegger, who turns out to be a complete disaster. Maybe the state would be a little bit different if that didn't turn out that way. And now we'll basically take anybody that agrees with us at any point.
People forget Reagan didn't just jump from
right
movies to politics. He's, you know, it was kind of that transition. First of all, he was head of the Screen Actors Guild, right?
Yes.
So he was head of a union, right? So he had a little bit of managerial experience. Then he goes into the role of being spokesman for GE, and basically becomes something of, I know, a pundit, kind of, you would say. He was writing columns, kind of becoming a thinker, becoming somebody who's kind of laying out his philosophy of government and the Cold War and a lot of topics related to that. people really underestimate how long that was, I think, in Reagan's life and how important that was in Reagan's life. He'd really kind of retired as a movie star. And in fact, I'm trying to remember, Greg, have you seen Reagan's last movie? He plays a villain and it's in color and it's absolutely fascinating to watch this voice you're used to seeing as being, you know, voice and face, commander in chief, leader of the free world. And I'm pretty sure he slaps a woman in it. Like, he really is kind of this fascinating to watch, you know, evil Reagan on the screen. And I think he's leading some like gang of thieves involved in car. It's not a great movie, but that was supposed to be kind of his big comeback as you know, a villainous actor. Didn't do well, and he kind of stepped away from it. The idea that, you know, he didn't just hop from one to the other. He did, you know, he took the time to do his homework, and I think there's no substitute for taking the time to actually learn about these issues backwards and forwards, know about policy so that you're conversant about them at a level beyond sound bites and catchphrases and things like that. And I don't know if Arnold did that. I think most of us had high hopes for Arnold. And I think you look at the condition of the state when it was when he began, and the condition of the state when he finished. Just not where I don't think it's unfair to say he just didn't live up to high hopes. Now, he had a Democratic state legislature the entire time, and that really limits what a Republican governor is going to be able to do. But in the end, I would put this question to America, Greg. Just how many members of the cast of Predator do we want to put in charge of states?
Carl Weathers for governor.
Carl Weathers has got to be running somewhere, you know.
That's right. Oh, man. Yeah, you're absolutely right about Reagan. He had well-developed his thinking long before he was ever on a ballot. You could just watch his Time for Choosing speech in 1964, which is 2 years before he ever ran for governor, to know just how well he understood this. And he certainly came across even better than Goldwater that year, quite frankly. But no, he knew exactly what he believed and was always underestimated all the way along. And one of the things that was interesting about Reagan is that when he gave televised speeches, they didn't put makeup on him. This is true. Michael Deaver used to tell this story. They used to just have him drink a glass of wine. And he would just get that little bit of rosiness in the cheeks, and he was good to go. Didn't even need the makeup artist. So how good is that of a transition?
That's a segue, Greg.
With online ordering, quick shipping, and personalized recommendations, Wink makes it so easy for you to discover the wine you love. Once again, we're talking about Wink, spelled W-I-N-C, which makes it easy to discover great wine. Because Wink's wine experts select wines matched to your taste, personalized for you, and shipped right to your door. And it all starts at just $13 a bottle.
There's nothing like coming home to a delivery box of delicious Wink wine selected just for you. It's the best day of your month. Just fill out Wink's palate profile quiz and answer some simple questions that your average store clerk just isn't going to ask or isn't going to be able to translate into a wine recommendation. Questions like, how do you take your coffee and how do you feel about blueberries? Then Wink sends wines curated to your taste. And the more wines that you rate, the more personalized your monthly selections will become.
Each month, there are new delicious wines, like the insanely popular Summer Water Rosé. There are no membership fees, zero. You can skip any month and just move on to the next month, or cancel your subscription at any time. Shipping is covered, and if you don't like a bottle they send you, they'll replace it with a bottle you'll love, no questions asked. And as I've mentioned a couple of times before, we got our batch, I guess it was back in March now, loved the two bottles of red. One was kind of a straight-up red, a little bit of a fruity flavor to it. The other one was a blend. We loved them both. The white was a little too fruity. I guess we were too optimistic on how we felt about blueberries at that point, Jim. But so we said, you know what? We don't like that particular bottle. I don't even know if we're going to finish it. And they said, no problem. We'll just credit you for the next month. And so we actually skipped April because we still had more bottles of wine to go. And we'll be all set for May now with that free bottle that they credited to our account. So it's fantastic. So Wink is the way to go. Discover the great wine today by going to trywink.com/martini, and you'll get $20 off your first shipment. That's spelled trywink.com/martini for $20 off. trywink.com/martini. All right, Jim. The left is also very much a Twitter over Mick Mulvaney. He is the budget director and the acting head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is the New York Times. Mick Mulvaney told banking industry executives on Tuesday that they should press lawmakers hard to pursue their agenda, and revealed that as a congressman, he would only meet with lobbyists if they had contributed to his campaign. Quote, "We had a hierarchy in my office in Congress," Mr. Mulvaney, a former Republican lawmaker from South Carolina, told 1,300 bankers and lending industry officials at an American Bankers Association conference in Washington. If you're a lobbyist who never gave us money, I didn't talk to you. If you're a lobbyist who gave us money, I might talk to you. At the top of the hierarchy, he added, were his constituents. If you came from back home and sat in my lobby, I talked to you without exception, regardless of the financial contributions, said Mr. Mulvaney, who received nearly $63,000 from payday lenders for his congressional campaign. So, Jim, this has got folks like Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown saying, well, it's obvious now that Republicans just do the bidding of the banking industry and they're high-dollar donors. This is corruption to the core. Mulvaney didn't actually say that he did what these people wanted him to do, but that he would take the meeting. Usually people donate to you because they agree with you, but it's easy to see why this certainly seems distasteful. Maybe it actually is distasteful, but it is kind of a reality check on the way things work.
You know, I was going to say, I go back and forth. You can argue whether it's morally wrong, Greg, but I don't know if we can argue that it's factually wrong. Would we all feel better if he lied to us and said, no, congressmen are really eager to meet with people who haven't donated any money to them. And in fact, they would never prioritize someone who had donated a lot of money to them over someone who hadn't. Let me put it this way. If two people ask you a favor, and one's your boss and one's your neighbor, which favor do you get on first?
Probably the boss favor, yeah.
Now, do we wish we lived in a better world where, you know, members of Congress were equally accountable to all citizens and would never prioritize those who had supported their campaign? Yeah, we do. But, you know, I mean, like, Greg, people are always complaining this administration is lying, often with good reason. Somebody finally told the truth. Do we really want to punish him for that? Right? Shouldn't we kind of, you know, this is what Michael Kinsley famously said, you know, this is a Washington gaffe when you get in trouble for accidentally telling the truth. I mean, he's speaking to a group of bankers and it doesn't look good. Should he tell them no? Should he, you know, dude, those donations won't help you get meetings at all. Oh, okay. You know, like, if nothing else, Mick Mulvaney is not insulting our intelligence. So I'm not going to say three cheers for Mick Mulvaney. I'm going to say one cheer for Mick Mulvaney for just telling it like it is, acknowledging an ugly truth that none of us really want to admit or recognize. But I think, you know, and here's the thing. The idea that you'll ever have a political system in which a lawmaker will not be more receptive to meetings or discussions or suggestions from people who have supported. I mean, imagine, let's take money out of it, right? Let's just say that you're a longtime volunteer in local politics and you knocked on doors for them and manned phone banks and did all that kind of stuff for a particular lawmaker. You versus some schmo off the street, who should he be more quicker to have a meeting with?
Me.
I mean, we could say, you know, in a perfect world, it would be equal. But like, no, I think most people would, I think it's pretty self-evident. Most people are going to be more receptive to helping out those who've helped them in the past.
Yeah, and there's kind of a Rick's Cafe reaction among the Democrats and the media here, because, I mean, Democrats, like, they don't take marching orders from Planned Parenthood or big labor or environmental groups and that sort of thing. The idea that you're not aligned with these groups either because you're ideologically in sync or you get money from them or both is just kind of ludicrous.
Yeah.
So anyway, plus Mick Mulvaney is basically right now asking the government to give him less power at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
That's a good point. If you're, you know, if you really don't like this critics of Mulvaney, well, then let's make his Consumer Financial Protection Board less powerful.
Amazing day as always. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to visit our friends at Wink and get that wine delivered right to your door starting this month. Try wink.com/martini. And tune in again Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.